Okay. So I'll start by. Later. Okay. So I'll start by summarizing what we did yesterday. I think it was yesterday. So I was talking about quantizing BF theory in four dimensions for the gauge group SU2. So what we had done, we had started with a triangulated manifold in 4D made of four simplices that we glued together. So this thing is not a synthetic symbol, it's a four simplex. And a four simplex is made of five tetrahedras. So here represented in the dual picture. So this is a tetrahedra, these 5 points. And each tetrahedra is made of four triangles, these four lines. And in total, the four simplex is made of 10 triangles, so that you get the numbers right. So what we had done is that we had discretized the B field, which is a two form, on the triangles. Then we had discretized the connection on the tetrahedras. And we had done a lot of calculations. And finally, what we got as structure at the end is that to each triangle, we associate a representation of SU2. So here I've put four of them. Well, in general, every triangle has a representation. And we associate intertwiners to each tetrahedra. And then the amplitude that we have is that for one four simplex, I take the five intertwiners, I contract them together, and that makes what we call the 15J symbol. And the amplitude is made by doing the product of all four simplices of these guys, and then I sum over all possible representations and intertwiners. The only thing to remember, it's about the gluing. What happens when I do when I glue two four simplices is that, as I said yesterday, between the four simplices, I glue using the identity on the intertwiner space. What does it mean? It means that this intertwiner is the same as this one, and that I sum also on all possible intertwiners. So that's what we did yesterday. So now I've got this amplitude, which is the spin form amplitude for BF theory. And the question is, what do I do with it? So you can take the 15J symbol, put it in a computer, and compute it many times, and then you'll realize it's not much fun. So what we do, actually, it's that we're going to look at the boundary stuff, like Laurent had started to say. So if I take a 4D manifold and I look at its boundary, it's made of tetrahedras, lots of tetrahedras glued together. And if I look at the dual of that, I will get a spin network. Each tetrahedra is going to become a four-valent intertwiner. And on each line of the graph, I will get a representation of SU2. And so that's exactly the same Hilbert space as in loop quantum gravity. So if I do that, I can start by taking like a 3D triangulation, which I will call sigma, for example, and I put a spin network on that, a four-valent spin network. And I can try to construct the projector on physical states, just like in loop quantum gravity. So that's my initial hypersurface. I will take the same triangulation on my final hypersurface with the same graph. And in between, I will put my cobordism, meaning a 4D triangulation which has these two things as boundary, a triangulation. So then what happens is that if I use this amplitude and I put it in there, I sum over all guys which are inside the bulk, then this is going to define the projector on physical state, which means that one, it doesn't depend on the precise triangulation here, as long as I take as triangulation something which is of the topology sigma times R, meaning trivial topology. Second, it's a projector.
So this graph downstairs is the dual graph of some triangulation?
Yes. I can't draw it. But yeah. To each point, to each vertex, you put a tetrahedra. When you glue the tetrahedras along the line. So I was saying it doesn't depend on the triangulation of the bulk. Therefore, it is a projector. And you can check that it projects on the space of flat connections. So it's cool. It's actually, it's not surprising at all, because this ugly thing, we got it by discretizing delta of the loops. So it just means that we didn't do too many mistakes of calculation, but it works at the end. Yes, more or less. yeah, I mean, it's of course infinite. It's what Laurent was saying. You have to gauge fix that thing. But in the end, you know the answer, so you'll get it. well, of course, you can do little tricks by going to the quantum SU2. At root of unity, and then all the sums are finite, and then you can do everything precisely. But in general, it works like that. So the only subtlety is if now you take, you can also take a bulk which has a non-trivial topology, and then you can wonder what it does, and actually it's kind of messy. It doesn't even define a projector, so you can't do very funny things without it, but with it. But you can still compute a transition amplitude, if you can call that transition amplitude. I mean, correlation between initial and final boundary. OK, so that's what we did yesterday. So today, what I want to do is couple BF theory to an extra term in the action which depends on the B field. So my path integral that I care about is something of a type IBF plus I times a function, which I know we'll call phi of B. And I want to compute that path integral. So here, that's a function of B. I will start by just putting it downstairs so that I don't really care that it's an exponential of something. So how do you usually do that in quantum field theory? You introduce a source for the B field. Yes. And then you replace B by, you express B as the operator derivation respect to the source that you introduced. And then you evaluate the whole thing at a zero source. So how to write all that? Psi of D respect to the source of. Okay, so that's in the continuum, and so we'd like to do that more precisely in the discrete case and see how it changes the amplitude that we have here. So in the discrete case, we saw that we had integrals of a type, I integrate over an element of a Lie algebra. Can you still see in here? Good, okay. I integrate over some group elements of in SU2. And I was integrating exponential of I, there was no I, trace of B, G. So now I want to introduce a source, just like here. So I'm going to introduce a plus trace of B times G. And I will put a subscript S here, meaning source. And so this is this term. So. And but this, you can evaluate it exactly. It's pretty simple. I mean, if you do the integration of a B, you're going to get something as like something which I will put, I don't know how to call that, things on the side. It's not very precise. G plus GS. That, and by that, I mean something which is just the delta function on SU2. What?
GS.
It's in the group. That's why I call it G. Yeah. And now, when you want to compute some observable which depends on B, you're going to insert as operator, you're going to replace B by the derivative with respect to GS. And so when you look at it, you see that it just means acting with the generators of SU2 on the group element G. So what it means to put a source here, if you look at this formula, is that before we were saying that the holonomy must be flat, and now we're just fixing the holonomy to something non-zero. But anyway, we're going to evaluate everything on GS equal to the identity. So we're still making things flat. It's just that if we compute an observable respect which depends on B, I will have to act on that partition function with generators of SU2. So here, where am I being sloppy? It's exactly where I've put the sloppiness here. It's that that doesn't make any sense, what I wrote. But it is what it really means, it's the delta on R3 of a projection of a group element, of a sum of a projection of a group elements on the Pauli matrices, for those who care. And it is actually just that plus a measure, a term which comes from the Haar measure, which is something in 1 over cos theta, where theta is the angle of the rotation. And it's that little factor which is responsible for the fact that in the spin four models, usually you find as array spectrum j plus 1 half and not square root of j times j plus 1. So now that we've found how to represent B as the generators of my group, we can move on to trying to impose the constraints of the constraint B field that we had seen yesterday. So let me remind you the constraint that we had. It was Bij, which BKL, where these guys are Lorentz indices, is equal to epsilon AJKL times B, where B is just epsilon IJKL, Bij, which BKL, with a factor 24. Here? Because there's a plus. Did I? Oh, yes. Ma, plus. Yeah, maybe I wanted to put a minus. I just put the minus there by habit. Well, I guess I can remove it. Okay, so I was on the constraints here. Did I say something wrong again? Okay. So now we care about SO4, BF theory. So I'm going to do exactly the same thing as we did with SU2, except I'm going to replace everything with SO4, meaning that the generators are not going to be generators of SU2, but generators of SO4. Actually, I'm going to use generators of spin 4. But if everybody remembers, it's just a product of two SU2. So now this is the constraint in the continuum. I want to discretize it. So what do I do? First, I'm going to do a kind of duality transformation, meaning that here I can rewrite that using expanding all the indices as lambda, where these are space-time indices. And I can first invert the role of internal indices and the space-time indices. Actually, you can show that this is exactly equivalent to that condition here. As long as B is non-zero. So as long as the tetrad of the B field is non-degenerate. So it is this constraint that I'm going to discretize. So maybe there's some slight discrepancy between what would have happened if I had discretized these guys and these guys. But well, we neglect that just the same that we neglected that that little sloppiness. So here, what we had done to discretize is that we associate the B field to triangles. So I define a discretized B field associated to each triangle as the integral of that two form on the triangle. And so here I will get a B vector, bivector, because there's two indices. So and now, so I'm going to discretize this guy use on these variables. You see that if I just insert two integration here. This one?
Yes, so why is this wedge product proportional to epsilon?
Oh, that was the constraint that I wrote yesterday, oh, the first thing. So I'm back to trying to put gravity.
Oh,
so
I see. This is what you want to achieve.
Yes, okay. I think so. So we back to the constraint that we wrote yesterday, and we want to discretize it, and then to see how it's going to constrain my amplitude by thinking that I replace B by the generator of spin 4 everywhere. So now I discretize that. So what I will get, it's for every couple of triangles, which I call delta and delta prime, this guy is just the volume form. So here I'm just going to get the volume span by the two triangles. Remember here that I mean four volume. So that's just the discretization of that. And here I mean the four oriented volume, so it can be positive or negative depending on the relative orientation of the two triangles. So now I'm going to look at one for simplex. So in one for simplex, there's three types of couples of triangles. There's the case where I take the same triangle, delta equal to delta prime. There's a second case where I take two triangles which belong to the same tetrahedra. So for example, this guy and this one. And then there's a case where the two triangles do not belong to the same hypersurface. So the actually four volume is going to be non-zero. It means, for example, this one and this one. And so in the first case, I get as constraint that that constraint on the B field associated to one triangle. And that's what we call that. We call that a simple bivector. We can rewrite that in terms of self-dual and anti-self-dual part of a B bivector, meaning that B plus ij, I define it as one half of bij plus epsilon bij, and the anti-self-dual with a minus here. And this constraint actually just reads that the norm of B plus is equal to the norm of B minus. So that's my first constraint. So as we will see, this is just a constraint on the representation that I attach to each triangle. Now I have a constraint on each intertwiner, which is going to come from couples of triangles that belong to the same tetrahedra. In that case, I see that the four volume is still zero. So the constraint is epsilon. I will just drop all the indices now because it's simpler. It's equal to zero. And that I can rewrite it, assuming that this constraint is satisfied as epsilon b delta plus b delta prime times the same is zero. That means that bivector, the sum of the two bivectors corresponding to the two triangles, is simple. Again. And then finally, there's the true bulk conditions, where delta and delta prime share only a point. In this case, I will get that epsilon ijkl b delta ij b delta prime kl is equal to plus or minus the four volume of my four simplex. So here, actually, the only thing that I'm going to keep in mind for later is that it just means that I'm going to forget about the four simplex. I'm just going to say that this is just the same for all couples of triangles that share a point, and that, I mean, for each couple of triangles of my four simplex. Yeah? Okay, that condition means that if I take the product of a B field corresponding to that triangle and to that one, I'm going to get the same up to a sign if I was taking this one and this one. And that for all couples of triangles which are not in the same tetrahedra.
So does that mean you're imposing that all four simplexes have the same volume?
No, that's for one four simplex.
So you're only imposing that in one?
Yeah, here, what I mean by, I'm too high. I mean, all these guys belong to the same four simplex. I'm looking at one four simplex. Okay. Yes. So one thing to keep in mind that condition actually is trivially satisfied if we already have that. I mean, for all couples of triangles belonging to the same tetrahedra. So when we do the quantization, we can forget it, as long as we strictly enforce this condition. So now, what we're going to do is simply replace all the B's. By generators of a Lorentz group, or SO4 in our case, and we're going to solve these constraints and see what are the constraints on the representation and the constraints on the intertwiners. And then we will have a model for a spin foam model for gravity.
Question?
Yes? And that? One thing is that you must use that if you look at the four B field, B by vectors associated to the triangles, the four triangles of a tetrahedra, then the sum is zero. Okay, I'll write what I mean. So if I take one tetrahedra, it's made of four triangles, and I have that the sum of the bivectors associated to these four triangles is zero.
Why?
It just comes from that, that it's a closed thing.
So B is closed?
Yeah. Well, here, yes. Or if you want, it's a constraint, an extra constraint that you can put. But anyway, in the discrete case, it just corresponds that each tensor product here at the intertwiner is gauge invariant, and it just means that it is an intertwiner. So if you want, in the quantization of SU2, if I replace all the B's here by J's, it is already taken into account because you have at the sum of generators at the same on the same tetrahedra is zero because you have a gauge invariant state. Is it satisfying or? Okay. Okay. So what you do that if I take two things here, well, it's kind of a pain to explain. But basically, you replace, if I'm looking at one edge here, and this one, these two triangles, I can replace this B field by the minus the sum on the four others, on the three others. And then I have that this one cancels with this one. And, well, basically, you just apply this this condition and the other one a few times, and you get it. But there's lots of notation, so I can show you later. Is it okay, Thomas? Okay, you will see. Okay. So let's do a little representation theory of spin 4. So spin 4 is generated by six things, all the jij. There's the spatial ones, which generate SU2, and the boost, which generate rotation in the fourth direction too. And you can introduce the self-dual and anti-self-dual generators. And the same with a minus here. And what you check is that the plus generators and the minus generators commute, and both of them form an SU2 algebra, which means that I've got this splitting of spin 4 into SU2 left and SU2 right. So it means that a level of a representation of spin 4 is given by a couple of representation of SU2. So now when I do BF theory for spin 4, on each link I'm going to get a couple of representation of SU2. And the intertwiners are going to be also a couple of intertwiners of SU2. So that is the representation level. At the level of the group also, I can represent any group element of spin 4 as a couple of group elements of SU2, which I will write like that. So one thing which is interesting for later, first I will give the Casimir operators, so of spin 4, and there are two quadratic form on the Lorentz group. There's the first Casimir, which is simply jij, jij, which up to a factor that I always get wrong, is simply the sum of the Casimir of the left and right sectors. So it means that it will be JL, JA plus 1 plus GR, GR plus 1, I mean J. And there's a second Casimir, which is due to the second scalar product on the Lorentz group, which is with the epsilon. And this is simply the difference of Casimirs of the left and right parts. So what is interesting for us is actually that there exists a notion of simple representation, which is a representation for which the second Casimir is zero. And this means that actually the left sector is just equal to the right sector. This is interesting because it's the representation which have a vector invariant under SU2. In SU2 generating the spatial rotation. And how do you see that? It's that the original rotation, the original SU2 is just the sum of J plus and J minus. So it means that to get this SU2, I just take the two SU2 that I have, so the two angular momentum, and I couple them together. So if I want to have a state of spin 0 here, I need to have two states of equal spin here and here. So as soon as I have that, I can have a state of invariant under the special SU2. If you want to be more precise, you can just see that a representation of spin 4 can just be decomposed on a sum of representation of SU2, where the spin runs from the difference between these two spins and the sum of these two spins. So the only case where I have a representation, a singlet, it's when JL is equal to JR. So, and moreover, I can give, it is interesting for later, but I can give the state which is actually invariant. It's simply 1 over square root of the dimension of 2J plus 1 times the sum of a magnetic momentum running from minus J to J of JM tensor J minus M with a little factor that I always forget, a sign, J minus M. So basically this is just the singlet state if I couple two angular momenta. Finally, to conclude the representation theory, we just need one more thing. It's the fact that SU2, that doesn't exist a unique SU2 subgroup of spin 4 because the special rotation depends on which four vector they leave fixed. So if I take a vector in on the free sphere, which is the same thing as spin 4 quotiented by SU2, so remember that the SU2 is the one which leaves the vector 1, 0, 0, 0 invariant. So now I can have another SU2 subgroup which leaves n invariant by using the group element that takes that vector to that arbitrary vector. So it's just the subgroup. Which leaves that invariant. And so here, I should also have vectors which are invariant under each of these SU2s. So I will define the vector J. I mean, that's the representation. That's the choice of the SU2 subgroup. That means that I have a state invariant under that subgroup. And I just define that by J, which depends on G, but depends on my normal, acting on that singlet state. Okay, now we're ready to solve to write the Barrett-Crane model. Is that so? First, I'm going to impose this constraint on each triangle. So, as I said, I replace all the B's by J's. So, as I've just said, this means that the representation associated to that triangle is simple. So basically, I can drop that subscript and say that on each triangle, I associate this representation. Oh, it's that one. I just put an N afterwards to say it's because this G depends on N.
Oh,
yeah. Maybe, how do you want? I can put it downstairs if you want. Is it better? Okay, so this is the first constraint. Second constraint, it's that if I do the sum of the J's associated to two triangles, on the same tetrahedra, then the sum is simple. Somehow, this means that the intertwiner is going to be simple. What does it mean? It means that if I look at my intertwiner, so I've got here, I've got simple representation. Am I still writing big enough? Okay. Then this decomposes must decompose only on things which are here simple. And that not only in that splitting where I put 1, 2, 3, 4, but in every possible splitting. So also if I put 1, 2 together, and if I put 1, 3 together. So the fact is that there exists a unique solution to that constraint. Oh, I've got. So it's the intertwiner, which is expressed in terms of a singlet state. So I have my four representation on each edge, and I do the integral of a spin four of G acting on the first, on the four guys, on the four singlet state. Okay. What you can check is that if you act with something which is of a type simply left on that state, acting on the state 1 and the state 2, then it's going to be exactly the same thing as if you take that same group element, but on the right side, acting on this 1 and 2. So if it's the same action, it means they have the same Casimir. It means that you've solved that. Then you can also do a check that using that formula here, I can do this integral exactly and show that that intertwiner, where am I going to write it? Here, decomposes as simply the sum of J of that. So here I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, and that's the only intertwine, and that also in all possible ways. Meaning that the coefficient in the decomposition that here I had left arbitrary is fixed to 1. If you read all the other papers, we have a factor here which is dimension squared, but it's because I'm using a different normalization. And one can show that this is actually the unique intertwiner that satisfies this constraint. So since it's the unique, there's no point of discussing further constraints. And you can directly write the Barrett-Crane amplitude. So let's have our symbol. So here I've been discussing one for simplex for a moment. So on each triangle, I said that I have simple representations. So here, for example, I've got J1. Here I've got the same with J2 and J3 and J4 associated to one tetrahedra. And here the tetrahedra, I'm going to put the unique intertwiner that I wrote there, which is named after Barrett-Crane. So now the difference with the topological BF theory is that when I'm going to glue four simplices together, I'm still going to put the same intertwiner here and here. It's necessarily the same because it is unique. But instead of inserting the identity here, it just means that I fix the intertwiner there. So it's really constraining the BF theory from that point of view. And by doing that, we hope that we're getting gravity. So to solve the constraints, you see that there's a unique intertwiner given the four representation here, which I call like that. And now when I'm going to glue tetrahedras together, I mean four simplices, I'm just going to put the same intertwiner on the other four simplex, which correspond to the same tetrahedra here. Okay, the difference is that before we had included in BF theory, we had put between four simplices, we had put the identity, which decomposed onto every possible intertwiner. So that was BF. Now Barrett Crane, I insert simply that unique intertwiner. Okay. Oh yeah, yeah. The J's are associated to triangles. So these four triangles are shared between these four simplices, so they have the same label. So we do just as before. Now for each four simplex, we have five Barrett Crane intertwiners. We're going to contract them together and get the amplitude of the four simplex, which is now going to depend only on the 10 representations, because the intertwiners are fixed once you're given the representation. So there's only 10 numbers, and so we call it a 10J symbol. So this is taking the five Barrett Crane intertwiners and taking that trace. And I sum over all possible representation, simple representation associated to the triangles. So that is the amplitude for one triangulation. Okay, so let's try to see a bit more what is this 10J symbol. As I said, we've got a formula for that. For the intertwiner, so I can actually write what it happens when I glue everything together. So the 10J symbol is simply the integral over five group elements, which are associated to each tetrahedras. So since here tetrahedras are represented by a point, I'm just going to call them vertices. That's five of them. And then what I have is that I'm going to do the product on all the edges here of my graph, which correspond to triangles. I know it's very confusing to represent tetrahedras by edge and then by vertices and change that all the time.
And those intertwiners are SU2 intertwiners or SU4?
They're spin 4 intertwiners. No, they're always. I mean, the intertwiner here is invariant of the global spin 4 rotation. It's just that the way that we construct, because of the simplicity, it means projecting each of these representation on the SU2 singlet.
Right. So I can think of them as intertwiners of the group
SU2. Well, of course, if it's invariant to the spin 4, it's also invariant to the SU2. Okay. So here, for each edge, I'm going to put, I have the singlet here and the singlet here. And I have a group elements which correspond to the intertwiners. So okay, I forgot the zero everywhere. Okay. So by S of E and T of E, I mean the source and target vertices, so it means the two edges, the two end vertices of my edge. So the two tetrahedras that share the same triangle. So this is actually called the spherical kernel.
So could you read what you
mean? Oh, I'm sorry, here I've put too many things. Okay, let me write it again. Yeah, lots of indices, it gets confusing. Okay, so for each edge, I've got a given representation, because here. And then at the level of the vertices here, I have an insertion of my G, which is here. So because I'm on that edge, this S of E and this T of E are the two end vertices of my edge. This is called the spherical kernel, which I will write like that. Source and target, so the two end vertices. Okay. And what you can check is that this is actually equal to 1 over the representation, 2j plus 1, of the SU2 character of the left part of S of E, the right part. Yes. Times the same on the other side. Meaning that it's just going to be 1 over 2j plus 1 of sine of that 2j plus 1 times theta divided by sine theta, where theta is the angle between these two group elements. By the angle between these two group elements, I mean that I will write it somewhere else. Meaning that for a group element here, I act on that vector, and I will get a norm. And that angle theta is defined by the scalar product of the n, which correspond to g s of e, and the other one. Everybody followed? OK. Yes. Well, I'm sure there's some extra eyes maybe somewhere, but I don't know where they are. So the tangiciable can be written as the integral over 5 normals associated to each tetrahedra. So an integration over the free sphere, 5 of them, of 1 over of a product over all edges of 1 over dj sine of. I've got how many? I've got 0 minutes. Okay, I'll finish soon. Oh, okay. Ah, can okay. Let's go on. So, okay. So I've got this tangiciable for each for simplex, and I'm going to multiply them all together, and I'll get my spin form amplitude for the Barrett train. So what we hope afterwards is that if you look at this tangiciable, there's a kind of semi-classical regime into which this guy is up to a measure factor, must look like exponential of I times the radial action of the four simplex. And then, of course, since you multiply all of them, you'll get exponential of a radiaction associated to the whole 4D triangulation. So I'll do that next time, but I'll just say why it looks like we get that. It's because you take the sine, and as you all know, a sine is simply two exponentials. And then as I do the product over all edges, here I'm just going to, if I take one of them and I multiply over all the edges, I'll just get exponential of I times the sum of that. And up to a constraint that I'll explain later, which is actually that these angles theta comes from these normals, this is just the action that Ruth must have explained to you, which is the area radial calculus action in 4 dimensions. And what I'll say next time is that we can prove that very easily. If you have 2 moments, I can do it.
Can I ask that? If there were 2i and with a minus?
Oh, yeah. So I thought that everybody can fill that in.
But so, because in Ruth's thing, that theta was a deficit angle. So are you trying to say that here this theta is somehow a deficit angle?
Yes. What's going to appear is that these ends, which are associated to each of these tetrahedra, is actually can be interpreted as the normal to the hypersurface, I mean to your tetrahedra, And then this theta is the deficit angle associated to the triangle, which is obtained by taking the scalar product between these two normals. I think I need to stop.
Do you want to explain something more?
I can go on. Yes, 5 minutes. okay. So here I see that I will enumerate all the vertices with the indices ij. So I've got my angles theta ij, which is defined by this scalar product. So I can rewrite that constraint, that this guy, by considering the Gram matrix, G like Gram, and seeing that this matrix is of determinant zero. I mean, how do I see that? It's simply that these guys are four vectors and there's five of them. So if there's five of them, I can introduce like numbers, VIs, such that the sum is zero from one to five. And then I've got a null vector of G, which is just given by these numbers. So since I've got a null vector, the determinant is zero. Okay. So now what we can do is just rewrite this measure in terms of these angles. And some work by Laurent shows that this measure is simply equal to the integral over the theta i's, j's, of sine theta ij times delta of det of g. So basically, there's only this constraint to be taken into account. This sign cancel these signs, so I just have a product of signs on the top. And then what we do is that we're going to write this constraint, but in its differential form. What do I mean by that? Is that here what we have, it's you have that the sum of I and of I of VI and I and J is zero for every J. So in particular, I can rewrite that as the sum of I and J's of VI VJ cos of theta IJ is equal to zero. And then what we do, it's a little trick, is that here we just remember that these were unit normals, and that actually is just the closure of a four simplex, meaning that if I have the five normals associated with my four simplex, these are the three volumes of each tetrahedra, and it just means that my four simplex is a real four simplex, so that closes. And so these guys is the three volume associated to each tetrahedra. Then if I know that, but I know that VJ is simply equal to the area of a triangle shared by these two tetrahedra times, I forgot the sign here, times the four volume of my four simplex. Okay? So now what we do is that we take this, we differentiate it, and we use this constraint. So it means that now we are going to get that the sum of I and j's of the area, d theta ij, is zero. That's what we call the Schlafly identity. So now I do this splitting. And what I have is that here I'm going to get the integral over all theta ij's of, I forget these factors because they're not important, of exponential times I times the sum of all edges of a sign, because there can be plus or minus signs here, and because of it's a sinus, d j theta a. Okay, so now when I'm going to look at the fixed point of that integral, of that action, to do a saddle point approximation, I must look for the fixed point of that, taking care of a constraint. So the fixed points are going to be given by the sum of epsilon dj times that, plus a Lagrange multiplier taking care of that constraint that I wrote there, the Shoffley identity. So I get that the fixed points are given by epsilon dge is equal to the area times lambda for all triangles. That means that all the signs must be the same, and that the area is discrete, is given by the dimension of a representation attached to my four simplex. So you see that here you get two terms, which is, in the approximated of that, it's exponential I plus the sum of the area theta I, which is the rejection, plus a term which is its opposite, meaning that I've changed the term orientation. And actually, there's a slight problem is that there's also degenerate, some degenerate term here, which corresponds to the bound of my integral in 0 and pi. And everything would be so beautiful, apart from the fact that when people did numerical calculation, they found that it's this shitty term which dominates everything. So apart from that, this model represents gravity. I mean, these degenerate things are not unwelcome. I mean, actually, we expect them. It's simply that from in the original action, I mean, we had that. You can check that the degenerate tetrads dominate the path integral. So it's normal that here they dominate the path integral too. Except that, like if you follow what the proposal of Carlotte for the graviton propagator and all that, what he says is that the boundary conditions that you put are going to be such that the bulk is not going to be degenerate, and that the main correlations between the boundaries is going to be given by the Regia action. I mean, it's prettier like that with representation theory and all that. And like that, you can also make contact with like spin network spaces. Else, you wouldn't be able to do that.
What happens with this other minus signs and the signs?
Here? There? Oh, it's this sign here.
I mean, the sign is like the I.
This one?
The other.
This one? Yeah. I've put here. It's an epsilon, it's a sign. So here I should have put a sum over the two, but what I'm saying is that because of that constraint here, because of this lambda is the same for all the edges, all the epsilon must be fixed to be the same or the opposite. I mean, if you assume that these two guys are positive, which they are. Yes, this is plus or minus, this is always plus, and this is always plus. This lambda does not depend on E. So this guy is either plus, in that case all the epsilon must be plus, or it's minus, and then all the epsilon must be minus.
But epsilon is, it's not a variable,
right? Yes, here I've got a sum. So what it means is that when all the epsilon are positive or they are all negative, it means I've got a saddle point. And then I can do that approximation. In the case that the epsilon have different signs, then I can't, there's no saddle point. It doesn't mean that you can't do the integral, but numerically you check that these contributions are very small compared to the contribution given by these two extreme situations. I mean, All that is like all these saddle point approximation, you just do them roughly, and then they're always checked by numerics afterwards.